Basil of Caesarea is one very good example of a classical method of dispensing advice or spiritual guidance, namely by letter. And we have three examples of letters from Basil, whose epistolary corpus, whose collection of letters is extremely vast. The first is his letter number 2 in the corpus, which is to his friend Gregory Nazianzen, and it dates from the period before Basil's ordination to the priesthood. Basil is himself still at this point a layman, enjoying a retreat, enjoying the experience of solitude, an opportunity to borrow both from the experience of monasticism, with which he was very familiar. Basil traveled to Egypt and experienced the life of the anchorites there and attempted to implement it in his own province of what would now be northern Turkey, and invited his friend Gregory Nazianzen to join him in retreat. As we'll see, Gregory did, but did this for mixed motives and later had to apologize to his own people for this, because Gregory joined Basil after Gregory's ordination to the priesthood by his own father, Gregory Nazianzen the Elder, who was at that time the bishop of Nazianzus. And Gregory, in joining Basil in answering this letter and seeking to live this life of beautiful solitude, was effectively running away from his own responsibilities as a cleric and as a presbyter. But Basil is writing this letter to extol the virtues of solitude as a means of opening up the heart to God. We'll see that in the second letter, of which we have an example, letter 72, he is writing as a priest. That is to say, he's writing as someone who's just recently been ordained, describing the monastic life in a way that is not uniquely monastic. That is, he's describing it and extolling the virtues of it, rather like what Athanasius does in his Life of Antony, as a way of providing a model for the whole people of God. And interestingly, in that letter we'll see, he doesn't really use the word monk at all. He constantly refers to the Christian, the person who is the ideal Christian living in community. So the first letter, or the first letter we'll consider, letter 2, is about solitude. The second letter, dating from his early clerical years, is on Christian community, using monasticism as a symbol or an example. And the third letter, number 173, comes from the time after Basil's ordination as Bishop of Caesarea, and he's writing to a laywoman who is being encouraged in her own life of ascetical virtue. So let's look first at letter number 2. He is, again, writing to a friend, and he begins in a rather classical way, and we can skip through the first section rather quickly. There's a highlighted phrase, "I carry my own troubles with me." It's a kind of a classical way of being self-abasing and saying, here I am living this life of solitude, but I haven't really taken it to heart as much as I should. I'm not pretending to be a perfect example of this. If you drop down to section 2.2, he gives his idea of what solitude is for. Again, this is someone who's going to become a model of clerical spiritual advice, but at this point he's advising as an ascetical, not quite hermit, but someone enjoying the benefits of solitude. "We must strive," he says, "after a tranquil mind, an inward nous, the deepest part of ourselves that experiences hezukia, inward stillness, inward tranquility." And he says that this is easiest to do when we have the opportunity to be in solitude. And of course this is true. He's advocating a protracted period in solitude, and one can generalize from this and point out that one needs to have a rhythm of involvement with others and then an opportunity to be one by one's self in order for certain aspects of the spiritual journey to be strengthened and deepened. And he makes this point throughout this letter, as we'll see. If you drop down to the dark bar that has the text, and these dark colored bars with white text are my own commentary, this next section is on the value of solitude. And he says that the way of allowing this nous to become tranquil, the innermost self to acquire hezukia, is, he says, through chorismos apu tou kosmou pantos, through separation from the whole world. Chorismos, a separation, an almost cutting off of one's connections. And interestingly, of course, this is a sort of a spiritual zeal, a fervor for solitude, which will later be mitigated by his discovery of the need to be in community and of serving community. But nonetheless, it's a very valuable treatise. and represents the fruit of his own philosophical studies. We recall that Basil had the opportunity to study at Athens, and he's writing to Gregory because Gregory was one of his schoolmates, his classmates in studies at the university in Athens. So he says, if you drop down to the next paragraph, the highlighted section, solitude is of the greatest use because it stills our passions. Katunadzusa tapathe. It is a quieting down, a stilling, an inward stilling of our tendency to be caught up in compulsions and obsessions and addictions, which easily take control of us. And he then gives three recommendations. There needs to be a place for us which is separate from our involvement with other people. We need to have what he calls pious exercises, and he describes them as we go on. And then he praises this state. What could be more blessed than to imitate the choruses of angels? So prayer, and particularly prayer with hymns and psalms, and as we'll see, interspersing prayer with the experience of quiet and of scripture reading is an important element of the spiritual practice that he's recommending. Quiet, he says, this hezukia is the first step in our sanctification, this inward stillness. It's a means by which we allow God to bless us. And he says, the mind thus is saved from dissipation and ascends to the contemplation of God. He talks, of course, as the tradition always does, about the virtues that are both the prerequisites to this and also which are facilitated by the experience of doing this, that he says there is a beauty that shines about it. The soul forgets its own nature. It devotes its energies to the acquisition of good things that are eternal. And he gives the classical virtues, or some of them, self-control, sophroshene, manly courage, andrea, righteousness, the biblical virtue of dikaiosune, and wisdom, phronesis. And all the other virtues enable the good man, the good person, to discharge the duties of their life. He then gets very specific about the Christian practices that facilitate that. And I've highlighted in the colored bar the centrality of what we would today call Lectio Divina. He says the study of inspired scripture is the chief way. It is the principal means of finding our duty. He says that in section 2.3. And then I've highlighted some of the biblical examples, and here he's following on an ancient tradition that we will find models. We might say today a kind of biblical hagiography, holy people whose example we can follow. Joseph, that is Joseph of the Old Testament, is a model of chastity, because he doesn't succumb to the temptation of Potiphar's wife. Endurance is taught to us by Job, and he says David teaches us the combination of gentleness, of meekness, and of great-heartedness, hardy against sin, but compassionate or meek towards human beings. David is an example of this, and he says, so is Moses, who was also great-hearted and who was also gentle. And using these examples that are drawn from the scriptures, he then, in section 2.4, says that prayer after reading finds the soul fresher. It stirs up its yearning for God, its pathos. And this is a very strong word. It's pathos, it's desire, it's learning, it's ardent zeal for God. This rhythm of prayer and reading will fire up our deeper desire for God. And then we discover that it is having God established in ourselves by means of memory is the indwelling of God. Now, of course, he doesn't mean this is taking the place of or even is superior to the sacramental indwelling of God, but he's strongly emphasizing a spiritual practice that allows one to feel, to cultivate, and to develop the sense of God's indwelling through having God in memory. Then he talks about the virtues that involve awareness of others. And so he's verging on now, hinting at what will happen when one who has learned the way of spiritual growth then begins to share this with others. He says, we have to know how to converse. We have to know how to interact with others. And he gives a whole series of 8 little bits of advice to interrogate without being too eager, without too over-earnestness, to answer without trying to display, without trying to show off, not to interrupt someone who has something to say, not to ambitiously desire to put in our own word, to be measured in speaking and hearing, not to be ashamed of receiving from another, or to be grudging in giving information, nor to pass on someone else's knowledge as if it were one's own, to admit honestly what comes from another and not to pretend that it's our own insight. So these skills are valuable in all of our interaction with one another, but they are especially valuable for the one who is growing in virtue and is being called into the responsibility of offering spiritual guidance and leadership to others. It goes on in the next section, the highlighted section, to talk about being courteous, cultivating gentleness. Harshness is always to be put aside. And then finally, in the conclusion of the section, 2.6, he says that our appearance, and here he's talking about not being concerned with clothes, not even being concerned too much with what we would call hygiene, unfortunately, is that we have the appearance of mourners in order that that may be our natural condition. We are not concerned with external things. And here he's filled with zeal for the example that he's found among the solitaries of Egypt, and he's trying to emulate them. This particular excess or this particular form of zeal, it does not find a prominent feature in his later writings. If we drop down then next to letter 22, he's writing now as a cleric. He's writing now as a recently ordained priest, having been ordained by the Bishop of Caesarea to assist in the administration of his diocese. And here again there are connections with Gregory Nazianzen's father. The Bishop Gregory Nazianzen, the elder, was involved both in the installation of the bishop who now ordains Basil, and Basil in his turn, when he becomes bishop, will eventually be instrumental in forcing Gregory Nazianzen to accept the Diocese of Sasima, which is a problem in terms of their friendship. Their much vaunted friendship is challenged and even becomes for a number of years, a kind of enmity because of Basil's later desire to try to use his friends in important dioceses and use his own brother, Gregory of Nyssa, in a kind of a desire to oppose the Homoians, the later Arians, in the great struggle for orthodoxy. But that's a kind of a side point. There's a lot of political stuff going on. But in this letter, he describes what he calls it, the perfection of the life of monks, the teleotes of the monastic order. But his goal is to use monasticism as a model for what all Christian life should be. So if we drop down to the third paragraph where it begins to be indented, he really is saying it's the Christian. The Christian should do these things. It's not the monk. It's not the one who is uniquely called to a particular form of community life. These are ways of living that we should all engage in. And you can see a whole series of virtues there. Ought in all things to become superior to the righteousness of the law, neither swearing nor lying, not speaking evil, not doing violence, not being angry, always patient. The traditional virtue lists, which are a significant part of letters of direction. And that really is part of our purpose in looking at this, to remind ourselves that in many cases, spiritual guidance, spiritual direction, when it employs this epistolary, when it employs this mode of sending a letter to another, consists in lists of virtues that are recommendations for the person who is receiving it. And then there's another dark bar, a green bar, summary of life in cenobitic, that is to say, the kind of community where people are dwelling together in large groups rather than in smaller contexts or in solitude. He's now emphasizing the role of community. He here gives a series of recommendations that are echoed in the Rule of Benedict and in a lot of other monastic texts and become very standard for how we are to interact with one another in community. He says in this section between the two bars, giving careful heed to all things as the Lord's. The things that we are responsible for are ultimately, we are responsible for them as if they were Christ's. Each should think, should rather so think and act as though given by God to be slave to his like-minded brethren. We are as servants to one another. If you drop down to the next section, the bar, and this is 22.2, I've entitled it to serve each other as Christ. In all things, moderation or epiakeia, is to be shown. Moderation in canon law, this is the principle that invites one in interpreting a law to seek the intention, the will, the purpose of the lawgiver, to try to discover the principle that underlies the law. He's using the term moderation, which is another way in which this Greek term epiakeia is used. And finally, respect to be shown to everyone and each to put the other before himself. A very Pauline principle, as many of these statements are drawn from the letters of St. Paul and Paul's own virtue lists. A highlighted section, every Christian ought to do so, to do everything as done to the glory of God. Hos eis doxan theou, a phrase that recurs constantly throughout Christian history, that in all things God be glorified, one of the mottos of St. Benedict from his rule, and of course this becomes an important kind of battle cry for the Society of Jesus as well, the Jesuits. Then in section 22.3, in Christ's love, to grieve and be afflicted at one's brother's faults, but to rejoice over one's brother's good deeds, a kind of empathy in experiencing in community, and to conciliate one against whom one has complaints. This is all in section 22.3. One who has been corrected in first faults and received pardon is to be allowed a second opportunity and then seek to be reconciled, or the community is to find means of reconciling people. The sun should not go down on wrath against a brother, or a brother having anger with us. Again, a very important principle, which in this case is taken from St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and which becomes a classical text throughout monastic literature as well. That's, again, as much as we're going to look at in this letter, which is concerned with Christian community, again, bearing in mind that Basil has moved from, as a layman, a fascination with an interest in solitude as the place where you learn virtue and engage in contemplation. Here, as a presbyter, as a priest, who is engaged in helping to administer a diocese, probably looking forward to, knowing that someday he's going to be a bishop himself, is now looking to community as the context which he is both advising, to which he's offering spiritual help, and in which he is inviting Christians to find their opportunity for mutual sanctification. And then a reminder, a very brief reminder, in letter 173, that as bishop in later life, he was involved in a ministry of spiritual direction, of spiritual guidance, which consisted in sending specific letters to individuals with particular needs. And so here we find very much what we've seen before, a virtue list, a list of specific kinds of characteristics that he thinks are important for this, what's been translated as canoness. This would be a woman who lived in a community, but not the same as nuns. That is to say, they're not the same as Parthenoi, as holy virgins, or from deaconesses who were responsible for assisting in the preparation for baptism of women. The canonesses, or the canonicae, were a specific order in the Greek churches at this time, and they represented a kind of religious life which was also involved in a certain kind of ecclesial service as well. So if you drop down to the first set of numbered indented sections, here he gives a list of virtues, talking about how it belongs only to the few to be consistent in keeping the tongue in check, the eye under guidance, working with hands, number two, according to the mark of doing what is pleasing to God, observing propriety in dress, moderation in eating and drinking, and avoiding excess in acquiring necessities. And then he also talks in the next set of indented and numbered sections, self-control, seriousness, commitment to prayer, generosity to the poor, lowliness of temper, contrition of heart, soundness of faith, calmness even in the face of depression, and an awareness of the coming judgment. So we see three different letters, one addressed to a friend, one more generally extolling the virtues of Christian community, using monasticism as an example, and here a letter from a bishop to a consecrated laywoman, who is in need of a particular series of kind of reinforcing reminders of the virtues that are proper to her, a reminder of the different modes of spiritual guidance that can be provided through the context of letters.